This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Hannah McCarthy. Educational opportunities for prison inmates vary pretty wildly across the country. Some have the chance to earn an associate's degree. Some might have access to auto mechanic training. But there are few correctional facilities that turn out master craftsmen. New Hampshire State Prison is one of them. In downtown Concord, next to Gibson's bookstore, there's a small visitor center for the Chamber of Commerce. You can pick up brochures, postcards, maybe a mug or a stuffed moose. There's local art from the League of New Hampshire Craftsmen, and then there's the furniture. An inlaid federal-style mahogany sideboard, a contemporary bookcase made of figured cherry and ambrosia maple.
If you didn't know it was made by an inmate, it would pass the jury of the furniture masters, no matter who you are or where you came from. We would like this person to be part of our organization based on the quality of that workmanship.
Terry Moore is a member of the Furniture Masters of New Hampshire, a group of highly skilled craftsmen who highlight furniture making in the state. And the pieces made at the state prison are no exception. He says a lot of people hear prison hobbycraft and think basic or crude.
Because they equate, well, it's an inmate. It's something that they do. Like in a high school, you have a wood shop, and it's just, it's an aside. It's something that, oh, they also do a little bit of woodworking. No, these guys are going at it like you'd go after your master's degree. It's all in.
For 19 years now, Terry and fellow furniture master Tom McLaughlin have been visiting the Concord Men's Prison on a monthly basis, teaching inmates in the wood shop how to craft furniture.
It took a year, but that following year, each piece became part of our exhibition.
Some of these inmates become so devoted to the craft that their work becomes indistinguishable from that of a furniture master. And for most, these skills aren't going to be confined to the prison forever.
One of the things that people don't realize about prison is that these guys get out eventually, and that's one of the underlying premises of why we do what we do. They get out. And would you rather have someone that has spent days in and learning and mastering a craft, or someone pumping iron and wasting their life away?
Spending so much time with these inmates, Terry becomes a key figure in their lives as craftsmen, which means he's at the top of the call list for many of these men when they do finish out their sentence or make parole.
Inevitably, I get a call, and like when Donnie got out, this was February, and I was actually working on my house at the time, and I get the call, "This is Donnie, I'm out." And then I say, "Well, come on up for lunch."
When an inmate is released, Terry explains, they have to make many things happen on their own. There's a halfway house, there's a parole plan, but they may still find themselves in an unfamiliar environment after having been sequestered away from society for years, sometimes decades. He tells the story of one inmate, a devoted furniture maker in the prison workshop, who was placed in Manchester after his release. The city was essentially unknown to him.
He's been in prison for 20 years, and you know, the people at the halfway house give you a map and say, "Go find a job." So he came back 2 hours later. He got a job in a cabinet shop, and now he's the foreman of this cabinet shop, making all of the complex custom work for that cabinet shop.
As Terry sees it, these men are learning not just a trade, but developing a practice. By the time their furniture is good enough to appear in public exhibitions, an inmate is producing work that a full-time furniture maker would charge a high price for. The federal-style sideboard, for example, Terry says that would go for around $10,000. But inmates do sell their work while still incarcerated. Even without the overhead and clout of a professional furniture maker, this sideboard sold at auction for $5,000.
In this gallery here, the Furniture Masters nonprofit wing gets a percentage. They get 10% of everything that sells here. Then the prisoner gets a percentage, and then they're allowed to donate the balance to the charity of their choice. So they're not making a killing. They're making basically toothpaste and soap money.
In the New Hampshire Department of Corrections, inmates can earn up to $4 per shift working in either essential operations, that's meal prep, laundry, maintenance, or correctional industries, that's furniture refinishing, woodworking, license plate making. Inmates can have up to $1,000 in their prison account and can use that money to buy things at the canteen or for medical copayments. Restitution is automatically deducted, and inmates may also be paying taxes or fines. You need some cash flow within the prison system.
This is the only way, the only resource that if you're in prison, in state prison, making something in hobbycraft and selling it is the only way that you can legally make money while in prison.
What Terry means by this is that selling a piece that you make in hobbycraft is the only way to generate income from an outside source, from something other than an established job in the prison. Even with daily wages from an in-prison job, the cost of, say, soap or a t-shirt or ordered damages may mean that an inmate depends on money from family or friends. So even the small percentage made from selling a piece of furniture can make a big difference to the inmates in the program.
And this hobby's given me a lot, so that I don't have to rely on my wife or my family to be able to give me money to. I've been able to do it through hobby to take care of myself in here, which is a big thing for a lot of people.
This is Robin Knight, an inmate at the state prison in Concord. He's been working in the woodshop since 2003 and says he was initially a little wary of furniture making. But now, he says, he looks at the program as having been a saving grace.
You forget about where you're at, and it's more of being in an environment of almost like you're not here, not in the prison system. You're doing something that is meaningful to you and to others that you do stuff for.
Robin talks about furniture making as an act of giving back. That's not just the proceeds donated to charity, but the experience of working with other inmates in the woodshop, like one man who also works in the kitchen, who asked Robin about making a hutch for him.
So I said, well, no, I'll tell you what, he'd never done it before. He was in baskets, which is over here. And I said, you know, he came into wood, and I said, I'll help you out. So we started building a little hutch. So it's going to be a floor drawer hutch.
The woodshop at the prison is a large, bright, open space. Machines are whirring constantly, sawdust is floating through the air. Walking through, it feels like being in any skilled craftsman's workshop.
Well, when Furniture Masters came in, it gave you something to strive for. You know, it gave you something to push you forward, try to make you do something better on a better level.
This is Alan Eason. He's been working in the hobby shop for about 16 years. And he is looked to as a real master among those in the furniture program.
So it's changed how I do everything. I mean, it changes how you do, how you are in regular life. I mean, it pushes you forward. It makes you think about things more because you can't just slap stuff together. I mean, in the shop, it changed. Everybody did everything with power tools. And you see it change over to a lot more hand tools now. So it really changes how you do everything.
Alan stresses that hobbycraft and selling the pieces they make is not a business, and these inmates don't think of it that way. The practice of woodworking itself and of teaching others is the factor that keeps these men coming back every chance they get. Like Robin, he describes it as transportive. It gives him something else, something of value to focus on.
I mean, you come up here, it's not dealing with all the bull crap that you have to deal with in the units and all that. Because, you know, prison's not fun no matter where you are. So coming up here gets you away from a lot of that.
Absolutely, yeah. This is the best thing we have.
Eric Windhurst is the inmate who made the cherry bookcase on display in downtown Concord. He's set to be released in 18 months, and he thinks of that focus shift as the ultimate point of the Furniture Masters program.
You know, that is the goal. You know, that's why they come in here, to show us a whole nother level and range and way to perceive woodworking, and then that builds you up as a person, makes you, you know, more introspective, makes you more patient, especially patient. It really that's what it is. It's focus and patience.
Most of the inmates in this program put their small percentage of the furniture sales right back into making more furniture. They buy books, magazines, or hand tools that will help them craft the next project and improve their skill set.
And the self-esteem and self-respect transfers to, you know, life on, you know, outside of the prison in ways that nothing else in the prison can do for an individual who may not have a lot, you know, of life experience, you know, to go back out in the real world with.
Educational and vocational programs have been found to have a big impact on recidivism rates among prisoners. One 2013 study found that this kind of programming can reduce repeat offending by over 40%. But these programs take buy-in, even with volunteers. Machinery, tools, raw materials, and supervising staff can come at a significant cost. But at least in the state men's prison, the infrastructure was already in place.
Naively, I called the women's prison, and I believe that I said on the phone, "Hey, I'd like to come teach in your woodworking shop." And immediately learned that not only was there not a woodworking shop, there was not the opportunity to do anything sort of related to this possibility.
Leah Woods is a woodworking instructor at the University of New Hampshire. She's been there for 10 years now and joined the Furniture Masters shortly after coming to the state. That's where she learned about the prison outreach program and soon after thought of starting one herself.
I feel like learning woodworking and learning how to design and build furniture is a path to learning skills that I know are really important because I've seen them in myself, like patience and thinking through a plan, planning ahead, anticipating steps when you haven't done something before.
It seemed a no-brainer to Leah that a program like this would benefit incarcerated women just as much as it had men. But that hadn't occurred to the people with the purse strings.
I think when it comes to woodworking, it's likely that people in the position to allocate funding for, say, the new women's prison wouldn't immediately think that woodworking would be an important activity that the women would be interested in, or wouldn't be an important activity that could give them life skills or job skills or anything like that.
This spring, the state women's prison was moved from a smaller and inadequate space in Goffstown to a brand new facility in Concord. The space is three times bigger, and even though it doesn't come ready-made with a wood shop, Leah says the cards are beginning to fall into place. She met with the warden, Joanne Fortier, and a number of others who are interested in supporting a program like this.
Right now, what we potentially have is space. Nothing else in the space. No equipment, machinery, hand tools, books, nothing. Let alone someone to take care of the machinery, to teach classes, what kinds of projects, what kinds of techniques to teach. I feel comfortable that that part of the teaching will unfold.
And Leah knows that there's real interest for the kind of instruction she could offer. Though the designers didn't plan for it, a recent survey at the women's prison revealed that most inmates would be open to learning woodworking and furniture making skills. Making a career out of woodworking, while possible, is really difficult, Leah says. And she doesn't envision this program as being training for dozens of professional furniture makers. She has no singular end goal. Rather, she hopes that woodworking does for these women what it did for her: provide patience, foresight, and confidence.
Ideally, in my best case scenario worldview, is a way for women that are in the correctional facility to learn this one activity in addition to all the other things that they, you know, are able to learn there, and then hopefully come out of their time with one more skill, one more thing to potentially be excited about in themselves. And, you know, maybe that can lead to a job, maybe it can lead to self-empowerment or self-confidence.
Leah says a program at the women's prison, while on the horizon, is a long way away from being the kind of thing that you see at Concord Men's Prison. That space and the work that comes out of it is the result of years of time, patience, and repetition. Fortunately, those particular virtues go hand in hand with woodworking.
Coming
Coming up, producer Jackie Helbert reveals the deeper meaning behind a seemingly ordinary license plate. That's after the break on Word of Mouth. Welcome back to Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Hannah McCarthy. Earlier this summer, we put out a call for the stories behind your vanity plates. And when one listener reached out with the plate N1303K, producer Jackie Helbert had to hear more. Because, well, at first glance, that doesn't seem like a vanity plate at all.
8 at window number 18.
Well, the Department of Motor Vehicles is a very civilized place these days. So, you know, you take a number and you get called up to the desk. And I wanted to make sure that I got my vanity plate, so I made sure to do it in person. I filled out the form. There was a woman behind the desk who was processing my form and looking at it, and she noticed that the vanity plate that I had requested, N1303K, is obscure. And so she said, if you don't mind my asking, what is it that caused you to ask for this particular vanity plate?
8 at window number 15.
When I explained it to her, she actually started to cry. My name is Don Kreese. I am New Hampshire's consumer advocate. I represent the interests of residential utility customers at the Public Utilities Commission, and I am a dad and troublemaker.
My name is Felix. I'm 12, and I like baseball.
Nice. What position do you play?
I play first base, second base, and center field.
Don and Felix stop by our studio on their way to D.C. They're driving down to meet with lawmakers about Rose.
My daughter Rose is 16 years old. She is a high school student and an avid equestrian who specializes in dressage. Dressage is the art of, it's kind of like dancing on your horse. And she seems very good at it.
Rose isn't traveling with her family.
She has cystic fibrosis, and it affects not only her, but it also affects the family. Like, every night it will bring us up 20 minutes more just because she has to do a routine. And most people think, like, oh, this disease is for her, so it's going to affect her. But it's really more than just that, and it affects everyone around her.
Cystic fibrosis causes a problem in every single cell in the human body.
Cystic fibrosis, or CF, is genetic and progressive. N1303, Don's license plate number, is the genetic marker for CF. It causes a thick, sticky buildup of mucus in the lungs and other organs. There's no cure. It eventually will lead to respiratory failure and death. It's dangerous for CF patients to be around each other. They might pass around infections, which can be fatal. As a newborn, Rose became very ill.
Poor Rose, the way we learned that she had CF was she wasn't absorbing her food very well.
She was starving to death. Doctors call this failure to thrive.
As somebody who had a failure to thrive baby, I can tell you that the first thing they think of is, oh, maybe the parents are doing something wrong or actually doing something bad. But in our case, they were able to figure out pretty quickly that we weren't doing anything wrong or bad. And so they start just tearing their hair out, trying to figure out what's wrong.
Don said they tried every test under the sun.
And then finally, I believe it was a medical resident at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center who finally said, you know, we've been talking about maybe doing the sweat test on this baby. Why don't we just go ahead and do it? And they went ahead and did it.
It was simple. They just checked to see if her sweat was too salty. The results came back almost instantaneously. Rose's salt was off the charts. She had CF. Don said it was the only time he's ever sobbed in front of a stranger.
Once they did the test, they diagnosed her, and she started taking digestive enzymes in these little pills, and that's what made it possible for her to absorb the nutrients from her food.
Torturous months of watching your baby slowly starve could have been avoided with a basic sweat test. CF is known as the invisible disease.
When I was born, she was already 4, but I really didn't realize something was wrong with her until 10, because I actually thought that, like, everybody else's sister did their routine, and I didn't realize that there was something wrong with her, because for 10 years, I had just been It was just normal that every day she would, our sisters did that routine and they would do their best. And I didn't realize that this was only a Rose thing.
Rose follows a strict routine.
She inhales antibiotics and a drug called Pulmozyme that is supposed to thin out her mucus. And she uses a device called the vest, which is basically a machine that pulses air through two tubes that connect to a vest that she's wearing, and it jiggles her, which is supposed to shake the mucus loose. Before that machine was invented, people had to do that by hand, by kind of beating on each other, basically.
In the 80s, the life expectancy for someone with CF was only 10 years old. Medical advancements have bumped that up to 40 years and beyond. Even with Rose taking such good care of herself, it's not smooth sailing. Last year was really tough.
Really, the first time I really got that something was wrong with her when she went to the hospital for a month. Now I really understand that it's serious and it's life-threatening. When she was at the hospital, she was isolated there. So for a month, she was not allowed to go outside of the hospital. And I just thought it would be super hard to stay in that hospital room for a month. And I remember once she came out of the hospital, she was really happy and she wanted to immediately go to Boston and have lunch.
When Don first got the devastating diagnosis, he didn't let it keep him down for long.
So I helped lead the struggle here in New Hampshire to get cystic fibrosis included in the state's newborn screening program. So now every baby is tested at birth for cystic fibrosis, and the diagnosis comes very quickly, and there's no more failure to thrive. I'm very proud of that.
Since, you know, you guys started doing the test on all the babies, have you met anybody specifically whose child was treated and they caught it?
That's a great question. I had the experience at a CF family meeting I attended once of having a woman walk up to me, pull out of her wallet a little wallet picture of a really cute, sweet, healthy-looking baby. She showed me the picture and said, "My baby is healthy because of you, so thank you." That's how I get to go through life, knowing I did something good at least once.
Don isn't alone in his advocacy work. Felix has been practicing his talking points.
For a lot of cystic fibrosis family, like Dad said, it can cost $100,000 just to care for this. So the cystic fibrosis needs good insurance, so I'll probably be telling them how important insurance is because it can cost way more money than a lot of families have.
What do you want to be when you grow up? Do you have any ideas?
A baseball player.
Nice.
And I know baseball players, they make a lot of money, so I have already planned that I'll give at least half of the money that I get to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation.
That's really sweet.
Yeah.
Don's optimistic about the future.
I really believe that in my lifetime, and certainly Rose's, CF will stand for cured forever instead of cystic fibrosis, because we're making really remarkable progress. It's all about how human ingenuity can conquer both scientific uncertainty and human misfortune and make life better for everybody.
Don and Felix get into their Prius. It has NHPR stickers and a vanity plate. N1303, the genetic marker for cystic fibrosis.
Coming up on Word of Mouth, what happens when a church is no longer a church? Producer Ben Henry explores the deconsecration and condoization of a sacred space. That's after the break. Welcome back to Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Hannah McCarthy, and I'm here in the studio with producers Ben Henry, Justine Paradise, and Taylor Quimby.
Okay, so you guys, there is this church on Pleasant Street in Concord. It was formerly the Sacred Heart Church. Are you guys familiar with this church?
I think I walked past it.
Walked past it, yeah.
Yeah, on my way to town.
To my money, this is the most beautiful building in Concord. It's got this kind of Gothic Revival architecture. It's got this kind of peach-colored stone. these kind of sandstone red steps coming up to it, a green copper spire. That building is no longer a Catholic church. The building was sold. So my question to you guys, let's say there was a clerical error over at the city of Concord, and you are now the owner of that building, and you get to turn it into whatever you want. What would you do with that gorgeous building on Pleasant Street?
I think that any of these like big buildings should just be like a roller derby rink.
Concord doesn't have one.
I would turn it into a theater, a performance space of some kind. I mean, that's what it's made for.
Yeah, Concord could use like a really cool concert venue.
Yeah. What about a botanical garden? Wouldn't that be really cool to just fill it with plants?
Or like a public bath, like a la the Romans.
Ooh.
That would be cool.
Could be a rock climbing gym. Take advantage of those big,
big
tall ceiling.
I can't believe that place is empty. I live a block away from that church, and I never realized it wasn't a church.
Well, so it's not actually empty. It was sold, and I spoke to the person who helped to broker that deal for the church, and I ran some of these ideas past him. If, for example, I looked at that gorgeous building, Sacred Heart, and I thought, that'd be a pretty cool spot for a bar, does that fly?
No.
This is Charlie Burr. He's the business manager for Christ the King Parish in Concord. Here is why he would not let me turn Sacred Heart into a bar. The Catholic Church has really specific restrictions about how a church building can be used, even when it's no longer, you know, a church.
And it's interesting that you ask about that. One of the proposals we had was to turn Sacred Heart into a brew pub. That obviously would not be acceptable.
You say obviously. So is it just because the sale of alcohol is not allowed?
Yes, that is correct.
I don't know what I mean. It does sound like it would be a pretty cool place for a bar, don't you think?
It'd be a pretty cool place for a lot of things, but inappropriate in my book.
Here are some other things you can't turn a church into: a strip club, a porn shop, an establishment that provides, quote, non-therapeutic massages or tattoos. A former church also can't be used for performing or promoting abortion or any of the other medical practices that the church opposes, like human embryo research or in vitro fertilization. I talked to Peter Feuerhardt about this. He's a correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. You're also a journalism professor, is that right?
That's right. St. John's University.
Do other denominations of Christianity or other religions, is the Catholic Church sort of especially mindful of sort of the legacy of its buildings?
I think the Catholic Church is especially mindful of its legacy. There's a different theology of church, okay? Like a Baptist church, for example. That is known as a place where people gather to pray together.
A Catholic church is different. The building itself is consecrated, meaning it's separate from all the other spaces where we conduct our dirty, embarrassing lives. If God is going to show up anywhere down here on earth, this is the spot that Catholics set aside for him to do it.
So there's a sense of sacredness to church buildings that other Christian traditions do not have to the same extent.
Here's the thing, though. A church still looks like a church, even after it falls into the hands of, say, radio producers and becomes a botanical garden. It still represents Catholicism. So it makes sense that the church wants to have some control. And this is not a thought experiment. The number of Catholics in the Northeast is declining. Nationwide, young people like myself are less likely than our parents were to be religious. In a lot of places, there just aren't enough congregants coming to church and pitching in money to keep the lights on. Even when there are, it can be hard to find a priest for that church. Most Catholic communities are shrinking. Is that correct?
Right.
And
in the Northeast and the industrial Midwest.
Right.
Well, if you mark the growth of the church is growing in the South and in the Southwest. So obviously in the Southwest, a lot of that is immigration from Latinos. In a place like Atlanta, they're building new churches all the time. A lot of that is growth from Yankees coming down to live in Atlanta.
What this means for New Hampshire is that over the last 15 years, 28 parishes have closed, consolidating the state's Catholic community into fewer and fewer churches. New Hampshire doesn't get that much immigration of new Catholics. Actually, we've kind of gone in reverse. Lots of Catholic churches here were founded by immigrant communities. You might have had a Polish church, a French church, an Irish church, all within a couple of blocks of each other. And they all offered Mass in different languages. But now, second, third, fourth generation immigrants have integrated. They learned English, and there's less need now for all those separate churches. You can get by with just one church for a whole town. The end result? Empty churches, waiting for a new life in the secular world.
Why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay, I'm Father Mark Druin. I'm pastor of St. Andrew Bessette Parish here in Laconia. I'm also pastor of St. Joseph Parish in Belmont.
When did you come to Laconia as a pastor?
I was sent here in June of 2009. And the reason I was sent here was to facilitate the consolidation of the three existing parishes at that time.
Another pastor had just retired, and they were having trouble finding a replacement. Also, money was tight. They were going to turn three churches into one church. The scale of that undertaking kept him up at night.
You know, one of the things the churches did very, very well was to foster a parochial, you know, if you will, a central parish identity. And of course, now you're asking to break that up and come together to form a whole new identity.
Before that process could really get underway, the buildings of those former churches had to be dealt with. There's actually a process handed down by the Catholic Church for undoing the sacredness of a building.
And then as part of that ritual, we brought artifacts that were important to the community. For example, the large crucifix, the sacred oils, all the parish registers that have all the baptisms, all the important information in there recorded. And we brought those down to the church, and we did that in ritual format.
And this is a deconsecration process you're describing?
Correct. And so there was a special deconsecration Mass where during the Mass itself, you go to various stages in the church itself, and you acknowledge, for example, at the baptismal area, all the people who were baptized.
And had you personally gone through that process before, a deconsecration, or was that the first time for you?
That was my first time going through that.
How did that feel? It seems like it would be difficult.
Well, it is difficult. I think for Our Lady of the Lakes, for example, they had this very large crucifix that had been given in memory of Monsignor Norman Baldock, who had died in a motorcycle accident. So here's this big 7-foot crucifix, which is gorgeous, and to take that off the wall and to carry that out of the church, I mean, that's gut-wrenching. And then the thing that was even more is when the bishop walked out carrying the Blessed Sacrament out of the church, which for us is the very presence of Jesus Christ.
That building is now an evangelical church, which Father Druin said he prefers over a more secular use of that building. It means he never had to decide between tearing the building down or letting it become office space.
Yeah, because it seems a genuine trade-off, you know, to keep the building just to have it as a signpost to the past, even if it's, you know, say, apartments or offices. In some ways, that's better than tearing the building down. On the other hand, if you tear the building down, in a way, you've kind of fixed the memory of that thing in the past. It's no longer projecting into the future, and it's therefore not malleable anymore, in a way, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. And again, you know, also just to see a church as an office building, it just seems to undermine the significance of what that space was.
You know, we build things all the time that are going to outlive us, maybe outlive our children. And we act like it's not a big deal, but it is. We're asking someone in the future to remember us. For what it's worth, Sacred Heart Church in Concord is now condos. I know we had way better ideas than condos, but real estate here is tight, and I'm told those condos sold really quickly. There's another Catholic church in Concord that closed down as well. It was bought by the same developer. Frankly, that building's not as attractive, and architecturally, it would have been harder to convert it into anything other than a church. So it's being torn down. It'll be replaced with apartments. And who knows when they'll be torn down.
That was producer Ben Henry. This week's episode was produced by Jackie Helbert, Ben Henry, and me, Hannah McCarthy. Erica Janik is our executive producer, and our team includes Taylor Quimby and Nick Capodice. Maureen McMurray is director of figuring out which church organ pipe makes the spookiest sound. Music in this week's episode is by Poddington Bear and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have a question for us here at Word of Mouth, ask us. We're listening. Click on the Only in New Hampshire page at wordofmouthradio.org and submit your question about your state. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.